It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we're talking about the impact of the federal government shutdown on scientific research.
First, we're talking about the link between what you eat and how well your brain works.
Alzheimer's is on the rise in the United States. Some doctors say we can fight back by eating the right foods, getting enough exercise. We want to
know what you do to keep yourself healthy. Have you made a diet change recently and noticed a big difference?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question about what you should be eating, 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Dr. Neil Barner joins us now. He's the author of Power Foods for the Brain, an effective three-step plan to protect your mind and strengthen your memory. He's the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Dr. Barner, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, how widespread is Alzheimer's in the United States right now?
It's widespread and it's growing. We have 5 million Americans already affected by it. That figure is projected to rise, probably triple in coming decades. And for each of those people, that means their family members are affected. The financial toll of it is astounding. It's about $70,000 for one single person for residential care for a year's time, and you multiply that by 5 million people who are affected. But what really counts here is the personal devastation of it, that you've got everything that ever mattered to a person is ripped away and lost. So I've seen this personally. All four of my grandparents developed severe dementia late in life. My father passed away last year after a 10-year battle with dementia. It's a terrible thing. But the good news is that I think we can do a lot about it.
Well, I know that the focus of your book is on what we can do to, you know, prevent it and stave it off. But I am curious, when you see the growth of a disease like that, I don't know if it's epidemic proportions, but why is it growing like that? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, two reasons. The first is that there are more old people than there have been before. The baby boomers are reaching old age. But the other reason is I think that we are now reaping the fruit of what I would call the fast food revolution of the 1970s. People ate Well, frankly, people were not eating very well before. But with the advent of fast foods, meat intake rose dramatically, cheese intake rose, sugar intake rose, and our diets were not good and they became much, much, much worse. And I think that we're seeing the results of that.
So can we really avoid Alzheimer's if we eat the right foods? It sounds kind of simple.
Well, I think it is simple in the sense that a generation ago, heart disease was a mystery. If you were 50, you'd have a heart attack. And then researchers said, wait a minute, maybe that's actually not part of getting older. Maybe that's a disease process that comes from eating fat and cholesterol and smoking. And suddenly the risk factors for heart disease became abundantly clear. And now we know that you can prevent heart disease. You can even reverse it. Now, a generation later, we are doing exactly the same thing with brain diseases. And I give a lot of the credit to researchers in Chicago at Rush University there who set out interviewing thousands of people about what they're eating and about their lifestyle practices, exercise, how often did they lace up their sneakers. And then they looked at who stayed mentally clear as the years went by and who succumbed to memory problems, who lapsed into Alzheimer's disease. And other researchers are picking up the same challenge. And we have found risk factors for Alzheimer's disease that not only are they analogous to the risk factors for heart disease, in some cases they are exactly the same ones. And what is bad for the heart does seem to be bad for the brain. They're not identical, but they're very close.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned you were touched by Alzheimer's. I am too. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. And my grandfather is still here. He's going to be 98 years old. And he ate lard sandwiches. And my grandmother was, you know, she didn't eat a lot. She ate pretty well. And she got Alzheimer's, as did, you know, the previous two or three generations, you know, that came before her. So you think it's dietary and not a genetic disease?
It's both. There is a gene, and it's called the ApoE epsilon 4 allele. And if you get it from one parent, your risk of developing Alzheimer's is tripled. If you get it from both parents, your risk of the disease is multiplied by a factor of 10 to 15. And for many people, that's where the book would close. It's genetic. You're going to get it, and that's it. But what we have learned is that this gene can be modified. What the gene does is it doesn't give you Alzheimer's. What it does is it creates a carrier protein in the blood that escorts cholesterol around in the bloodstream and in the brain. And it appears that if you don't eat saturated fat, I'm speaking about the animal fat that's in, particularly in dairy products, also in meat, in eggs, and as well as the trans fats that are in donuts and other snack foods, if you're avoiding those to a great degree, your cholesterol is going to drop. There's less for that gene to do. And in the Chicago study I mentioned earlier, the people who avoided these fats had a dramatic reduction in their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Now, that's just one step, but it's a huge one. It's like smokers quitting smoking. It's a clear-cut risk factor, I believe, something that we have control over, and something that our limitation now is just, are people aware of the importance of it?
So you're saying we can't control the genes, we can control the risk factor to a certain extent.
Yes, and I think the most important issue is that some genes are dictators, the genes for blue eyes. They give orders, and you're going to have blue eyes whether you want them or not. But the genes for many diseases, Alzheimer's, diabetes, weight problems, those genes are not dictators and they don't give orders. They're more like committees that sort of make a recommendation. You could get Alzheimer's if you eat these foods. And interestingly enough, we saw that with cancer. There are genes for lung cancer. But what the genes do is they cause the body to have trouble eliminating carcinogens. So if you don't smoke and you're not inhaling carcinogens, suddenly that gene is left high and dry. So what if I had a bowl of oatmeal for breakfast? What if I followed a vegetarian diet? What if I'm not eating animal fat? Then suddenly the role that that gene might have is dramatically changed. And again, that's just one step. There are other steps that hopefully we'll talk about. But I grew up in Fargo, and I have to say I spent the first half of my life eating all the wrong things, but as did most of everybody.
Are we
but,
doomed if we did eat the wrong things? Can we still make a difference now?
There have been some really interesting studies, including things that you can add to the diet and also exercise. Researchers at the University of Illinois looked at people who are losing brain volume year by year. I'm talking about their brains actually shrinking. And what they asked them to do was lace up their sneakers 3 times a week, take a brisk walk. And it reversed brain shrinkage, especially in the part of the brain we call the hippocampus, which is the center for memory. So we're not just slowing brain shrinkage, we're reversing it. Researchers at the University of Cincinnati started using blueberries and grapes and foods that are very high in certain kinds of antioxidants called anthocyanins. They showed that even with people having memory problems, people up near 80 years of age, they could improve their memory. Now, don't get me wrong. You don't want to abuse your body and then when you're 85, start eating in a healthful way. Because researchers at Kaiser Permanente, found one of the most frightening findings of all. And they showed that the higher your cholesterol level, the higher your risk of Alzheimer's, but the cholesterol that seemed that they found was a problem was the cholesterol when you're 40 years old. So if you can imagine a high cholesterol at 40 causing Alzheimer's 3 decades later, well, it makes you want to get your diet in order as early as possible.
Yeah, it definitely does. So, well, let's get to the brass tacks of it. So what should we be eating right now, today? You know, the minute this interview is done, we're going to go to the grocery store. What should we be buying to eat that's going to help?
Well, there are four broad food groups that really ought to be our dietary staples. And those are fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and the fourth group is legumes, or you can think of it as beans, peas, lentils, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and beans. To that, I think everyone should be taking either a multiple vitamin or a vitamin B12 supplement. The relevant thing here is the B12, which is essential for protecting the nerves and the brain, and a lot of people are low in it. That's my prescription in a nutshell. The more we get away from animal products, dairy products and meat and eggs, the better. And the more we get away from fryer grease, which packs itself into donuts and snack foods and French fries, the better off we're going to be. For extra points, a little sprinkling of walnuts or almonds or sunflower seeds will give you some vitamin E, which is an antioxidant that has been shown to really cut the risk of Alzheimer's. And maybe finally, on the big food headlines, be careful about metals. Iron and copper have shown up in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. So that cast iron pan and those copper pipes are things that we're
bad?
Yes. Or at least that's the evidence that we have. You need a little bit of iron for healthy blood cells. But if you have too much iron, we learned a long time ago it attacks the heart. There is now evidence that it also harms the brain. And copper, you need tiny traces of copper, less than a milligram a day, for enzyme function. If you have too much, in the Chicago study, people who had the combination of a high-fat diet, high saturated fat diet, plus high copper intake, it was the equivalent of 19 extra years of aging with regard to the cognitive decline these people experience.
Wow.
Copper is found in copper pipes. It's added to multiple vitamins, unfortunately, and it shouldn't be. It's in shellfish, lobster, crayfish, crabs, shrimp, there's a boatload of it in liver. Now that we know where these things are, we can avoid them.
Well, lots of interesting stuff, and we're going to keep going after a break for news. We're talking to Dr. Neil Barnard, author of Power Foods for the Brain, an effective three-step plan to protect your mind and strengthen your memory. He's a founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Do you have a question about what to eat, what to do to boost your brain health? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you already doing these things? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now about the link between nutrition and brain health with Dr. Neil Barnard.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions about what to eat, what to do to protect your brain.
Dr. Barnard is the author of Power Foods for the Brain, an effective three-step plan to protect your mind and strengthen your memory. Now, you were talking about the four main food groups, Dr. Barnard, and, you know, it made me wonder, should everyone just go vegan?
Yes, they should. And the closer you get to that, the better off you are. And I have to say, for me, when I first learned about this, I thought, okay, that means you got to acquire a taste for folk music, break out the tie-dye, and whatever. But what I've learned, the way I've really made my own peace with it, is that if you think sort of international, if you're going out to an Italian dinner, I've got to tell you, they got a million ways to top your pasta that doesn't include animal products. Or if you go Mexican, they know what beans and rice and veggie fajitas are. And if you think about all of the Asian countries, they have a million ways of doing it. And frankly, it makes the way I ate as a child seem kind of pedestrian. So I have to say it's a good idea to get the animals off your plate.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got a bunch of folks waiting to talk to you. Kathy is first from Brookfield, Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
What do you think?
I was wondering about the relationship with coconut oil and preventing or reversing the effects of Alzheimer's.
Great question. Coconut oil has been promoted as a commercial product, and it's the controversy is that it's extremely high in saturated fat, the bad fat that we were speaking of. But some people have reported anecdotally that it seems to help. I cannot yet separate what is science and what is marketing. So I'm not joining the coconut oil bandwagon yet.
Okay, interesting. Thanks, Kathy. And on to Tim calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Interesting topic. I'm wondering if there's a blood test detect whether I have too much copper in my body. And also, I'm remodeling my house, and actually I'm using copper instead of the CPVC plastic because I'm worried about the chemicals in the plastic leaching into my water supply. I'm wondering which is the lesser of the two evils.
There's a great question. Thanks, Tim.
Okay. Oh, good heavens. You've really touched on a couple things. Blood test, yes. There is any doctor can test for this gene I was mentioning. It's called the APOE. That's APOE, all capitals, then small e and 4, the number 4. That's what they're looking for. Doctors can all check it. A lot of people don't want to know because in the past they felt condemned, but your doctor can easily run it and it's cheap. With regard to copper pipes versus plastic pipes, my strong suggestion is that if you have copper pipes, that you use them for washing and everything else, but I wouldn't drink it. Fairly simple filter can remove the copper if you wish to drink it, or you can get those big tanks delivered of water, the big tanks of water, and you can have them delivered and changed every week or so.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tim. And let's go next to Barbara calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
What about how often is an indulgence in something like Milwaukee's great frozen custard too often?
Right, that doesn't count,
got
right,
a really
Dr. Barnard?
Diet, fruits, veggies, green leafy, everything, beans, you name it. Don't eat meat, very little dairy other than custard.
The thing that I find almost always happens, it's very much like a smoker who says, I cannot live without a cigarette. But once they haven't had one for a while, they no longer want it. So I would plan to have custard on your 100th birthday. And by the time it happens, if you remember it, then I think you could have it.
Okay, I don't know if that's the answer she wanted, but there you go.
You know, you got to. I have to hand it also to the grocers. They have really stepped up to the plate. There are so many non-dairy ice creams and mayonnaise and everything else. Some of them are pretty high fat still. Some of them lower in fat, but the products are getting out there.
Now, your book is referring to a 3-step plan. We talked about exercise. We talked about diet. What is the third?
There are brain threats that I want people to be aware of, and this has been such a fascinating area. There was a NASA astronaut in training named Dwayne Gravelin. He was a physician, and he drove home from work one day. When he got there, there was a strange woman standing outside his house, and it happened to be his wife, but he didn't recognize her. His memory for her was gone, and needless to say, troubled her and him. They drove to the emergency room and they tried to sort out how could his memory have failed. He couldn't remember his own wife. And to make a long story short, the answer was he was on a statin drug, a cholesterol-lowering drug. At the time, this was unheard of. Since then, we have had hundreds of cases of people on statin drugs with memory problems. Now, before everybody throws their statins away, let me hasten to say that statins do lower cholesterol. Lowering cholesterol is a good thing, and this side effect is rare. But the moral of the story is, if somebody has a quick change in their mental status or memory, they should run to the bathroom and see what medicines the person has been taking, because they add up. And statins, among many others, are suspect number one with memory threats.
Okay. Good to know. Another phone call now. Catherine with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm a student at UW Oshkosh, and I have been conducting research regarding the lack of dental care for the underinsured in Wisconsin for about 4 years now. And through my research of other studies, I have found two different articles that have been published. The universities, one is in Tennessee and one in Switzerland, where they have found a correlation between an increased number of dental extractions and dementia. And I'm wondering if you have heard about that.
The question that we've been wrestling with is mercury. That mercury is used for fillings, and then mercury is a clear-cut neurotoxin. But many dentists have said they don't want to remove it because maybe the process of removal, you'll inhale it and you'll end up with bigger problems. It's still an open controversy. Where I am putting my money is I think it's good to remove it and to use a system that allows the vapors to be removed from the mouth in the process. But that's still a matter of scientific controversy, and nobody knows really if that's the issue.
So you haven't yourself had that done?
You're asking Catherine?
No, I'm asking you.
Oh, yes, I have.
You have. So you got your fillings removed. So if you're doing it, yeah, you're really putting your money where your mouth is.
Well, you know, fillings don't last forever. I mean, you got to change the spark plugs on them every now and then. And so when you, in other words, they crack, they break. And so when you replace them naturally, you can replace them with modern enamels. And there are lots of things other than mercury.
So are there any other things that we've missed that people really should be doing, even sort of baby steps that we could be taking that would really have a big impact?
Yeah. First of all, do get to know the plant-based foods. For many people, just the idea of what tastes great on your morning oatmeal and getting to know those foods, bringing them in your life. So experimenting with that is a good idea. At some point, do try a vegan diet for 3 weeks. Have fun with it. We have online programs that we use to help people. But one other thing is I encourage physicians and healthcare providers to remember that there are also medical conditions that affect the brain. A person comes in and they've got memory problems. Maybe it's Alzheimer's, but it could be low thyroid. It could be anemia. It could be, in some cases, gluten intolerance. Now, that's become fashionable to avoid gluten, but for about one in every 10 people, it's real. And so to be aware of these things is a really good thing, both for patients and for their doctors.
You think if people start doing this, we'll start seeing that Alzheimer's rate dipping again?
Only if they do it. A generation ago, we dealt with tobacco, and there was a lot of wrangling and fighting. And even in my own hospital, it was a big battle of whether we could actually ban smoking in the hospital or the doctor's lounge. Well, I'm happy to tell you that we won that battle, and tobacco's gone. We are now wrestling with food, and we have industries and tastes and habits and, I might even say, sort of in quotes, addictions lining up on one side and concerns on the other side. I think we can wrestle with that battle. We can win.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dr. Barnard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm talking to Dr. Neil Barnard, author of Power Foods for the Brain.
He is speaking at Milwaukee Area Technical College tonight at 7 p.m. He's also speaking this Friday in Green Bay.
Coming up next, how the federal government shutdown is affecting scientific research. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. The government shutdown is far-reaching, and we're taking a look at some of the ways it's affecting our communities. Tomorrow, we'll hear how it's affecting the agriculture sector and food inspections.
Today, we're going to talk about its effect on scientific research. Thousands of researchers have been furloughed around the country, and don't try visiting the National Science Foundation's website. It's offline until funding resumes. Here with us to talk about how science funding is being affected is Kenneth Rudinger. He's a PhD graduate student in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Physics Department. He's a member of the American Physical Society. We saw a piece he wrote in the journal Sentinel titled Government Shutdown Threatens Scientific Research. Kenneth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you were worried before this shutdown about how it would affect research. How is it affecting scientific research in Wisconsin and around the country?
Oh, that's a great question. It's really having a pretty negative impact on research. I think there are a lot of good examples. So in Madison, there is the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, which is part of the university. And fortunately, it has enough funding at this point, even though there is a shutdown to run through December, but they outsource a lot of their lab work, such as complex DNA sequencing, which gets sent to a lab in California. Because of the shutdown, that has to go on hold until there are more funds in place. So that's one example. Another, the United States Geological Survey has a science center in Middleton, and they've stopped doing a lot of their data collection currently. This includes samples that they take to monitor water quality. So these are just a couple of sort of local examples. I think there are a lot of good examples nationwide as well. So if you consider NASA, for example, they've furloughed 97% of their workforce of 18,000. What does this mean? Well, this means a lot of different research projects are now on hold. There is a forthcoming NASA launch to Mars is in danger of losing its launch window. This is the MAVEN spacecraft, or Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft. And the goal is to study the Martian atmosphere, understand why it's thinned. This could have a fairly important impact for our understanding of climate, and you know, we may just lose that. Hopefully that doesn't happen. There's still some time left, but that's another example. There are a lot of examples with the National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation, Center for Disease Control, Department of Energy, National Labs. I can give you more specifics if you're interested, but there's a whole bunch of different things.
Thinking back to my high school chemistry, it's really hard to stop and start experiments as you roll along.
Yes.
It might just sound to me like, oh, it's just a couple of days or a couple of weeks. Does this disrupt research for a long term?
Oh, yeah. This absolutely can have a profound disrupting effect because, you know, you spend all this time just getting ready to shut down the lab. Then you're not in the lab doing the research. And then when it's time to start up again, there's the additional cost of getting all the machines back online, getting all of your samples prepared again. So it definitely has, as you mentioned, you know, there is a non-trivial sort of startup cost just to doing these projects.
So some people might be wondering, do we need this federally funded research in the first place? Are we really losing that much? Can you make the case for federal funding of scientific research?
That's a great question, and absolutely. So I think there are a lot of really excellent examples of technologies that we benefit from every day, from that we have because of the federal investment in research. So, for example, magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs, we have those because of research that scientists did just studying fundamental properties of the atom several decades ago. We have GPS technology we have because of special and general relativity, it turns out. And these are things that, you know, we don't think about when we say, well, we should study certain aspects of science. And so sometimes there are applied projects that we have a specific goal in mind, and sometimes we don't, and it turns out that we can get really really great benefits from those research projects as well, you know, beyond what we were expecting. There have been a lot of research has been done into the economic impact of scientific research, and depending on what economists you talk to, you get a number between 50% and 85% of the United States economic growth in the latter half of the 20th century and now going into the 21st century comes from investment in scientific research.
Well, we don't know how long this shutdown is going to last. Days, weeks, I don't know. What do you see as the impact if the scientific funding isn't there for a long period of time like that? What will the researchers you mentioned earlier be doing? How much will that affect their work?
That's a great question. That's going to, I think, really have, again, a very negative impact. So you're just going to have these research projects not getting done. What also is going to happen is grant proposals are not going to be reviewed. Right now, the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health, for example, are not reviewing or accepting grant proposals. So this means that there's money in the future that even people who are not federal employees themselves are not going to have access to for their research. This also has implications for hiring. When researchers want to hire graduate students or postdoctoral researchers, they need to know that there's some certainty in the funding so they can fund these researchers. This is particularly important for people who are not U.S. citizens, for whom, you know, if they can't get a job at a particular time in a particular lab, that this window of opportunity to have them come to the United States and have them contribute their knowledge and expertise to our scientific efforts may just be lost. So I think that these are, you know, really sort of profound impacts, and the longer it goes on, the worse off we will be.
You mentioned earlier the U.S. Geological Survey here in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes research that is being affected, and you mentioned there are some other examples you could get into. Can you give us a taste of what other specific kinds of research are off the table for today and maybe tomorrow too?
Sure. Absolutely. So the National Institute of Health, they are currently not accepting any more patients for clinical trials. So this is, you know, to do a variety of different sorts of medical testing, to try new treatments for a variety of diseases, you know, such as cancer. There are, I believe, about 200 people a week that normally would start clinical trials with the NIH. And they're just not going to be getting this treatment now. We're just not going to be learning about, you know, are these good drugs? Are these good treatments? Are these things that can improve our quality of life? Are these things that can save people's lives? We're just not going to find out, you know, indefinitely. Hopefully it will be a short indefinitely.
So the piece go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, continue.
The piece you wrote, I mentioned, was before the shutdown. We're in the middle of a shutdown now. If you had a chance to talk to folks in Congress, what would your message be for them on scientific funding and the shutdown?
I would just remind them of the profound impact that scientific funding has on all of us in terms of economic impact, in terms of quality of life, in terms of just expanding our horizons, expanding the breadth of our knowledge. And you know, I would give them these historical examples. I would ask them, you know, what could change your mind? What could convince you that scientific research is worth investing in? And you know, hopefully they would acknowledge at some point at some level there would be some benefits that we accrue from scientific research, and hopefully I'd be able to convince them that the way to do that is to fund scientific research.
All right, Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kenneth Rudinger. He's a PhD graduate student at UW-Madison in the physics department. He's a member of the American Physical Society.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, how are you feeling today? Maybe hopeless, a bit lonely? Maybe you've got a headache or are suffering from the flu?
Well, before you rush out to the doctor or therapist, or maybe in addition to that visit, our next guest says there's an easier way to find some comfort from whatever ails you. A good novel, and she's happy to recommend the perfect book for you.
Susan Elderkin is here with us now. She's a writer, author, and bibliotherapist. She's the co-author of the new book, The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I wonder if we can start by getting a read on exactly what bibliotherapy is.
Well, bibliotherapy, as we see it, is the prescribing of books, and particularly fiction in our case, for life's ailments, be they physical or emotional or situational. I think we've all experienced a book that, if we read the right book at the right moment, has been transformative for us in some way, and our job is to try and find the right book for you at the right time in your life.
And what is that book for you? Do you remember a book that fit that bill?
Oh, a book that does it for me every time is, I don't know whether how big he is in the States, but the wonderful H.E. Bates, whose book The Darling Buds of May is a sort of 1950s classic from England, and there's not a cynical note in the entire work of H.E. Bates, and it's a great pick-me-up novel. I love it for its lovely, carefree vision of a bucolic English countryside existence, and it's... I live in America now, and it's a great cure for nostalgia for me and for homesickness.
Hmm. And in general, we're not talking about self-help books here or medical books. You prescribe specifically with your co-author, you guys prescribe fiction. Why fiction?
Well, that's our new thing in a way. I mean, it's not that we're against self-help books. They do a good job, and they're an important part of taking responsibility for one's own health and happiness. But it's quite easy to find your own self-help book. It's quite easy to see on the cover what it's going to promise to do for you. And our idea is that literature, 2,000 years of literature, has some really amazing minds working on what it is to be alive. And they've written stories, authors throughout the centuries have written stories about people who have struggled with the same issues that we struggle with every day of our lives. And it's missing out on a huge opportunity and resource if we overlook this as a way to expand our knowledge of how to deal with certain situations, or you know our love life or our domestic life, our losing a job or starting a family. You know, there's somebody in literature who's been there and done it, and possibly found a way around the very problem that you're facing.
What do you think it is about reading a piece of fiction when you're feeling a particular way that's so prescriptive? Because in a way, it doesn't make sense that a book, just mere words on a page, could help you feel better.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the magic of reading for me, and I've always been a big reader. I studied English at university, but I've always read since I was a child. And I mean, you know, on a basic level, there's something we escape into the world of the book. We kind of it's almost as if our reality has become suspended for that time, that we're totally caught up and transported. So that has a, for me anyway, that has a kind of meditative effect on my mind, and the rhythm of the words. These things all work on us, as well as the ideas in there. So I think books can work on you in many different levels. You know, it's not just the story, it's not just what the character did and what they say. It's the very act of being transported in that way. It's the kind of break from the worries of being, you know, we're doing whatever we're doing before we were reading, and whilst you're reading, you're kind of, I don't know, you're in another place, and you're experiencing another sort of mindset in a way.
And do you think it lasts? Can reading a book have a lasting effect? You get through it, and you feel somehow in a different place than you felt when you began?
Definitely, yes, definitely. I think, I mean, also one can return to books which have been curative in a way. I mean, I remember reading Anna Karenina when I was about 22 and just sort of being inspired by this brave, heroic woman who kind of was so animated and had such a love for life. And I think, you know, really inspired my own approach to living. And now I read it now. I'm in my 40s now. It has a slightly different effect on me now. I'm more sobered by you know, the ending of the novel. I don't want to say too much about it, but, you know, you bring your richness of experience of life to the novel, and it makes me think about relationships and complex things in a very different way. But yes, I think that stayed with me my entire life. And the interesting thing is that the nature of that relationship with that book has changed subtly over time. That happens with the really great books.
And you don't distinguish between physical stuff and emotional stuff in the book anyway. Is that tongue-in-cheek, though? Can a book really help you with a broken leg?
Well, we have a bit of fun with the physical ailments. I mean, obviously, I was just joking with my husband because he's a doctor. He's a real doctor. And, you know, if you've got appendicitis, you need to go to the doctor and you need to have it removed. And there's a limit to how much we can help with that. But you know, appendicitis is actually in our book, and we prescribe the really wonderful children's book, Madeline, by Benelmans. And it's a wonderful story. Lots of children's books are great bibliotherapy for adults, actually. And it's a wonderful story about a little girl who goes into hospital for appendicitis. And it's, you know, first of all, a terrible thing. But, of course, she gets lots of sweets. She gets lots of presents. And after a while, all of her peers from her orphanage want to have their appendix out as well. And so, you know, actually, that probably is quite a nice thing to read when you're in the hospital with appendicitis, to look on the bright side of it.
Yeah, you're pretty comprehensive in this book. I stumbled across an entry for hemorrhoids. There's a book that you recommend reading for hemorrhoids.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a walking cure. I think one of the things which, we work on different levels in the book. Sometimes it's, you know, we prescribe with the opposite thing. So, like with the cynicism, when you're feeling cynical about life, we give you a book without any cynicism in it. And sometimes we're actually encouraging you to get up and do the same as the person in this book. And Ian Sinclair's book, Downriver, is the narrator of that book just walks and walks and walks around London. And our idea is that increasing the circulation will probably improve your health generally, but also, if after a while your feet will hurt so much that it'll take your mind off pains in other parts of your body.
Which shall not be named. So about depression, now that's something that I can imagine a lot of writers themselves have struggled with, and it's a theme in a lot of novels. What do you recommend for depression?
Well, we divide depression into two parts, really, because it's obviously there's a sliding scale. You can be a little bit blue or you can be seriously depressed. And a little bit blue, we prescribe pick-me-up books. We have got fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, for instance, or Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons. You know, these are light and brightening reads. But for the seriously depressed, it's a very different thing that's required, we found. I mean, we've worked with as bibliotherapists with patients with severe depression, and it seems that people don't really, they want to know that they're not alone. They want to know that, you know, they're not going crazy, and they want to know of other people who have been in their predicament. And we prescribe The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. We prescribe The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Betty Blue by Grand Central Station, I Sat Down and Wept, I think, is in there, by Elizabeth Smart. These are books written often by authors who have experienced depression themselves and know really what it's like.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, I don't know, reading The Bell Jar, this is an author who committed suicide. Do you really want to read that when you're already depressed?
Well, the way we see it is Sylvia Plath didn't have the advantage of having a Sylvia Plath novel to read. I mean, this is in a way, I mean, it is a very serious thing that she did commit suicide. But for those who have come after her, I love to think of it as her helping people from beyond the grave. I mean, I know definitely of at least one person that I've worked with who was hugely helped by that book, because it's like, my God, this is exactly what I've gone through. This is exactly where I'm at. And you know, Sylvia Plath may not have had a novel like that to go to. I'm not saying that, you know, she necessarily would have been saved by it, but, you know, possibly, who knows? And I think one can't underestimate the importance of not feeling alone with one's illness.
Well, I want to see if we can leave our listeners with one more. We're running short of time, a little less than a minute here, but what do you prescribe for anxiety, which is another well-known malady of our time?
Well, a couple of things I would suggest for that. There's a beautiful book called The Man Who Planted Trees by Jean Giono, which is a very slim little novel. It won't take very long to read, and if you're feeling anxious about things, you know, you don't want to be faced with a great big fat book. And it's about a man who plants acorns in the ground, and he has a labor of love over it, and he spends his evenings sorting the acorns into piles of good and bad, and the daytime planting them. And, of course, great forests grow up in the wake. So it's about really encouraging you to just breathe slowly, calm down, and to look at things in a very simple new way. You know, our lives are filled with lots of complexities these days, and sometimes we just need to step aside from that and just take one acorn at a time.
All right. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It's been fun to be here. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Susan Elderkin, the co-author of the book The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You.
If you have a book that you turn to when you're down, when you're sick, let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.